When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
I don't know what those white people in this country feel. I can only include what they feel from the state of their institution. Now, this is the evidence. You want me to make an act of faith, risking myself, my wife, my woman, my sister, my children, on some idealism which you assure me exists in America, which I have never seen.
Welcome back to Black History for White People, a podcast where we educate, resource, and challenge white people about black history. I'm Brad, and on today's show are my co-hosts Katina and Garen. Today's topic is faithful anti-racism. We are joined by the Dr. Christina Edmondson and Chad Brennan. Dr. Edmondson is a higher education instructor and organizational consultant in the areas of ethics, equity, and Christian leadership development. She's also a co-host of the Truth's Table podcast. Chad is coordinator of the Race, Religion, and Justice Project and founder of Renew Partnerships, a Christian research and consulting ministry that focuses on diversity and race in faith-based organizations. They join us to talk about their book that was recently released called Faithful Anti-Racism, Moving Past Talk to Systemic Change. It's a really great book, and we'll say this again at the end, but if you go in the show notes and click the link, you can purchase the book and get 30% off if you use the code BHISTORY. That's B as in boy, history. If you use that code the next 2 weeks, it'll be 30% off. We asked Christina and Chad a bunch of questions about the book, and we were so thankful that they joined us and shared a little bit more about their thoughts and perspective as well as the book. We hope you enjoy the conversation.
So today we have two very special guests, Dr. Christina Edmondson and Chad Brennan. They are the co-authors of a book that they've written called Faithful Anti-Racism. So as we start off, whenever we interview our guest, we like to know you, get to know you for the human beings that you are outside of the things that you do, and maybe even what's fueled your passion for the work that you do. So I would like to say welcome. Thank you so much for coming. But also, I would like to know, who is Christina Edmondson? And then, who is Chad Brennan?
All right. That's a question right there. Yeah. Well, thank you all so much for having us today and giving us an opportunity to, again, tell who we are, but also to really center this project, this book that we worked on through the crisis, through the COVID. Yes. So, yeah, I'm Christina, born and raised in Baltimore City, Charm City. So that shapes a lot of, a lot of my personality, a lot of my experiences. A lot of my sense of self, product of the Black Progressive Baptist denomination. That's the denomination that's associated with Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. That's my childhood roots anyway. But have worshiped with and served and assisted and corrected in a variety of denominational and theological spaces over the years. Got a background in Christian higher ed as well as having taught at HBCU, Historically Black College University, and attended two of those. Academic background is social sciences, so sociology, race, class, and gender, family systems, my master's degree, and a PhD in counseling psych with an emphasis in trauma, every kind of trauma you can imagine.
Wow, awesome.
But on a more personal note, I'm a friend, a daughter, a mom. That's probably my toughest and most rewarding job, is the mom of a tween and a teenager.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It's real out here. They keep me humble. Two girls.
Yes, indeed. I can relate. And an adult. Teenager, and adult.
Now, Chad is a veteran. Chad is not new to this. He's true to this. So he can tell you.
He's an OG.
Background. in the parenting game. But yeah, that's that's a little bit about me. I love the local church. And yet, I think because of my trauma therapy background, I am able to talk really candidly and honestly about our problems.
Yes, indeed.
That must be addressed, because I really do believe there's enough grace to tell the truth. So,
yes, indeed. Mm-hmm.
That's mm-hmm. me.
So you're a modern day prophetess. Come on, sis. Well,
and a podcast. And
well,
a podcaster.
In the sense that they're disliked, maybe.
Right. That part. And in the sense that you're prophetically speaking to, you know, the issues. But also, you are a podcaster of one of my favorite podcasts, which is Truth's Table.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a thing. I think we're considered veterans in that sense too. We've been around for a few years now, and that has been a labor of love, but it's been a great opportunity to connect with people all around the country. First and foremost, Black women, who is our kind of our core targeted audience, but people from all backgrounds that identify and connect with that podcast. So thanks for bringing it up.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for sharing. And Mr. Chad OG Brennan, you want to tell us about yourself?
Sure. Why don't I start with those ladies that Christina mentioned? I am blessed to have four amazing ladies in my life. So I've got a wife, Lori, and I've got three daughters. So I've got a sophomore in college, a senior in high school, and a sixth grader right now.
Wow.
So that's my most exciting part of my life. And so as far as what brought me here, the real quick journey is I grew up in the suburbs of Dayton, Ohio. Really didn't engage on issues of race hardly at all until I was in my early 20s. Until I was in my early 20s, I probably would have been some combination of like trying to avoid saying anything offensive. I probably would have described myself as colorblind. In many ways, I was kind of cynical towards descriptions of systemic racism in society. So I would have in many ways been a person who would probably push back on a lot of the work that we do now, which I actually... I wish that wasn't my story, but I'm thankful because that gives me empathy and also understanding. So as we do training around the country and write and do various things, there's very few questions or pushback that we get that I can't go, okay, yeah, you know, I get it. I've been there and I can relate to that. So after that phase, I went into ministry for 9 years. I served in the Middle East, Queens, New York, and then in Columbus, Ohio for a couple of years. And it was when I was living, my wife and I were living in Queens, New York, that's really where issues of race in the United States really began to become front and center for me. Began to study scripture more in the process of doing ministry cross-culturally in multiracial churches and in all these different contexts. So I began to have my eyes open to my limitations, my lack of scriptural understanding in this area, and then just also my own prejudices and my biases and those kind of things started getting challenged in that space. So about 16 years ago now, left the campus ministry and started an organization that helps with assessment and training for Christian organizations in this area. And I would love to say that 16 years ago, you know, we had it all figured out and jumped right into it and got it all right. But honestly, especially those first 7 years or so, I think we got a lot wrong, honestly. We write about that some in the book, is really emphasized a lot on just bringing people together of different races, kind of multi-ethnicity and multiculturalism and cultural intelligence and those kind of things, which can be really helpful and beneficial. We can talk about that. But in many cases, that can kind of really miss some of the underlying dimensions that continue to perpetuate dysfunction in the church by just doing, you know, cross-racial unity gatherings or even multiracial organizations if they're not done in the right way. And so the process of working in those spaces and seeing both the challenges, but then also the damage that those kind of environments produce, as we measured that and we did assessments and surveys, just kind of shifted our focus and me personally more towards issues of justice. And that's really what the focus of the book is all about.
Hey, I want to jump in before you start getting some good questions from these two, but you know, as someone who is kind of hearing you guys talk and even knowing the name of the book, and maybe you just talked a little bit about stuff, but like, why, I'm imagining some of our listeners are like, why do we need to talk about this stuff? Why is that important? So like for you guys, for both of you, like why talk about this? Why learn so much? Why eventually write a book about it? Like what's y'all's reasons for kind of getting into the space?
Oh, well, I'm Black.
What air is that?
And I would say even more so than that, because everybody who's Black is not a social scientist, right? But on a very personal level, I have Black children. I have Black daughters.
Mm-hmm.
And the biases that people hold,
mm-hmm.
When you combine that with power that they might have, social power, impacts laws and stereotypes. Mm-hmm. It impacts their reality, impacts their safety.
Yes.
It impacts their sense of self. So on a personal level, as a mom, I really care about my children.
Yes.
But I also think because of my faith convictions, we really are called, as a Christian, I'm called to love my neighbor. Now, I don't think you can love anybody that you don't know. You can imagine a spouse, a spouse being asked basic questions about their spouse and not getting it right. Like, what's your wife's favorite color? Where did they grow up? Oh, I don't know. I don't remember. We might start questioning, do you really love your wife? Do you know your wife?
Right.
And likewise, it's really impossible for us to even step up to the plate to begin thinking about that calling to love others without understanding or wanting to understand or know who they are. And that also means understanding the uncomfortable truths and the way that our own stories, our own backgrounds, our own cultural groups interrelate with other people as well. And that's when it gets, I think, anxiety provoking, but still necessary because love can be quite uncomfortable, the calling that we have to love our neighbor. So I think my faith conviction, certainly on a personal level. And also, I've always been just interested in understanding people. My academic background, as I mentioned, it's largely in the social sciences, starting off broad sociology and then kind of funneling down into psychology. And I don't think there's anything on the planet more interesting than people. And there are amazing things on this planet. There are very interesting things on this planet. But I just feel like people are right at the top of that list. Wow.
Yes.
We are complex, complicated. And individually we are, but also our relationships with each other. So I think the nerd in me is fascinated by that as well. So those are the three things I would say off the top of my head. How about you, Chad?
When I first began to see the value in really focusing on cross-racial dynamics, and initially for me, that was conversations about multi-ethnicity and multiculturalism, like I mentioned. It was kind of a missional / unity focus. I saw a lot of Bible passages that talked about loving, like Christina said, and also unity in the body of Christ or unity in the church and those kind of things. So I thought, oh, well, clearly I'm supposed to do this. But then the more that I stepped into that, I realized the complexities of what really does keep us divided. And then the more that I began to do that work, the more I began to see the dysfunction in the church and how that hurts us personally and also in our institutions. And then it just became a passion because I see just the incredible pain and suffering and hurt and loss that results as a result of this, both in U.S. Christianity and also our society.
Thank you. Both of y'all's answers, that was rich. Thank you both for sharing. So I'm going to go ahead and get a few of my questions out of the way, and I'm going to turn it over to Garen. So a couple of things for me, and I'll just go ahead and throw both of them, or two or three out there, and you guys can just take it away. One, we have a really diverse audience. And so while the podcast is called Black History for White People, and we three are Christians, we get a lot of people who would consider themselves anti-racist or beginning to do the work or in different stages of the work and may not be a Christian. So we hear a lot of times from our more liberal listeners, stop talking about religion. Why are you always talking about religion? And I always push back and say, you can't talk about Black people, the diaspora, period, but you can't talk about Black people in America without talking about how faith is interwoven. So, and then from Christians, we get, why are you always talking about race? And so there's that intersection I'd like you both to kind of speak to. And then also, you two are an unlikely pairing. We're talking about a white man and a Black woman, and it just don't go down like that every day. And, not equitably, not where you have a, highly educated, very qualified voice of a Black woman to speak into this issue. Most of the time when there is a white person involved, there is this appropriated wokeism that happens. And we don't get that from, you know, your book. I don't even get that from just talking to both of you right now. So it takes a level of humility as a white man, Chad, to step into the space and not be intimidated by the greatness of Black womanhood. You know, it takes that. But then it also takes a leap of faith for a Black woman to step into a space of trust, because we've seen so many, you know, white wokeians that will hijack the platform and not lend the mic or give the mic over to or yield to the Black voices. So I want you guys to speak to that. And then the third thing is, what is anti-racism? See, I'm getting all mine out the way. So y'all can just take it. I want to hear from you today. I'm excited.
Take it away, Christina. Which one of those you want to take?
I know. I was looking at you trying to like using telepathy. I was like, which one will you take? So what was the first one? Give me the first one again.
The first one is about the liberals saying, you know, stop talking about religion when it comes anti-racism, and Christians saying stop talking about race, period.
They should totally read this book. I'm not even trying to plug it.
Yep.
That's what we came here for.
Yes, indeed.
But I think it'll help them to both of those groups to understand why it's interconnected. So the American story, the story of the founding of the United States, has right at its epicenter this relationship between race and the development of race and racialization, and religion. And so it's hard to have a conversation about America, about equity, about what is race. There was a time period, if we're looking at even the 1700s, where Christian and white began to be used interchangeably.
Yes.
In major documents. And so those, now that might seem odd to people, but those things were very, very interconnected. Problematically so. And so I think that it's hard for us to have a conversation. Racism, I would make the case, requires lots of different conditions for it to persist. There are a lot of people who probably are like, why are we talking about this topic? They're like, oh, I like all the people, just treat everybody the same. You know, that would be their argument. But racism has to have these kind of pillars around it to keep propping it up. And I would give you a theological reason why I think that is, because it goes against kind of human design, like God's design for people, right? So it needs these forces to keep it propped up. And one of those forces is that it needs moral complicity. It needs moral justification. And one of the best places to go to get that is religion. And so it came in really handy in the 1600s and 1700s and 1800s and 1900s. And if you look on Twitter today, to have religious figures blatantly maybe advocating for segregationist practices, making theological justifications for enslavement, or telling people they really shouldn't care about racism today. Good Christians don't do that. Like, right. that's been baked into the story. So I would say for the people that are like, you know, the Christians who are saying, let's not talk about race, and for the progressives who, for example, may not be Christians, but they may be progressive Christians, who would say, you know, why are you talking about religion so much, that those things are deeply interconnected in this American narrative. And that's the context that we're talking about race in. So I knocked out one of those. Chad, go on, take one of the other two.
I got to give you guys a shout out first before I move on to the next thing. So I, in preparation for this, I had a chance to listen to a few of your previous podcasts. And they're fantastic. I was super impressed. And so for somebody who may be questioning the integration, so in the book we focus on how whenever you look at racism in the United States, you almost always see three things at work: economic forces, political forces, and religious forces. And so if you take any incident and just say, how are economics in play, how are politics in play, and how is religion in play? And so I think it's just fantastic, the work you guys are doing. And I just listened to The Cost of Racism, fantastic. And then also, I can't remember what you titled, but The Rise of the Religious Right, is that right? Is that the one?
Yeah,
that one right there. Man, that's really, really helpful context for anybody who would say, why do I need to talk about religion, because it's been such an incredibly powerful force in terms of racism essays. So how about if I answer the one about how we have this awesome combination, unusual combination? Yes. Okay, I'll go for that. So I'm super blessed to have had some really great relationships with African-American women for the last two decades.
Come on, Chad.
So it has been incredibly enriching in my life. Dr. Brenda Salter McNeil has been a mentor for probably well over 10 years now, and has just been incredibly encouraging with our work, and just has had some really key words of blessing and also instruction and even challenge at key moments in my life. And then there's a co-trainer that we've been working together for over 20 years, Michaela Gregory. We went to college together and then we got into this work. And so she and I often travel around the country and co-lead trainings together. And man, I've just learned so much in our time doing that. It's been incredible. So I have both experientially and then also obviously learned a lot from many other African-American women around the country that I've not had the chance to build a relationship with. But it was just super fun when I met Christine about 3 years ago now. So we met at a joint meeting of other leaders who are working in the space, obviously super impressed and known of her and her work. And I also enjoy Truth's Table. And so it was just fun. And it was really encouraging when she said yes to partnering on this project. And it hasn't been the least bit disappointing.
That is so awesome to hear. And thank you so much for listening to our podcast. And, you know, I'm glad that it is encouraging to you, especially since you guys have a whole book out. It just and you're doing the work and speaking and giving language to the whole concept of anti-racism and what it means to be a true anti-racist. But what is an anti-racist? What is anti-racism?
Yeah, so we made a decision to knowing that this would cause some people to cringe if we titled this book Faithful Anti-Racism. And I had been teaching a course already with that title. I've mentored a number of pastors and organizational leaders. And so in that leadership development cohort, I'd been using this language of faithful anti-racism. And so we debated, like, would we use this? We could probably find other names of this book. And we know that at this point, I would say that people have been so deeply socialized, and I would even use the language propagandized, yes, to have a knee-jerk reaction to the word anti-racism. But I still wanted to push into it. So most people are thinking about anti-racism from the last 5 to 10 years. They're probably thinking about some contemporary figures, some social science, but also historians like Ibram X. Kendi, for example, probably comes to mind for some people. And they are thinking largely of a academic, but also kind of pop culture, like it's made it into the pop culture vernacular, this concept. And they're associating it with someone like Kendi, for example, when they are thinking about anti-racism. When I use the language of anti-racism, someone with a social science background, I'm actually knocking on some doors that existed from a really long time ago. So yes, as long as you have had race and racialization, you have had people who have resisted that concept. And yes, you've had people like abolitionists. And so the abolitionism tradition is really, I think, is the origin story of anti-racism.
Yes.
And that goes back hundreds of years. And in that, we are able to draw on Mariah Stewart and Frederick Douglass, and in more contemporary context in the last 100 years, you know, Ida B. Wells, for example, yes, Fannie Lou Hamer, et cetera.
Yes.
And that's happening way before the last 10 or 5 years, right? So anti-racism really is an acknowledgement. There's some presuppositions in there. There's an acknowledgement that the context that we are in is racist. And now when people hear that, they kind of get in their feelings. But let me just explain it simply, that there's a race-based bias, that mm-hmm. your racial group warrants you or affords you or gives you particular access points or deprives you of those. And that racialization was necessary in order to have a race-based chattel slavery system, which lasted for well over 200 years in the United States, because we needed to quickly identify the people, the group that would be at the bottom of that system. The work of people like Charles Darwin was also really informative in helping to shape this kind of categorization of race. And so that's what race was about, starting from the 1600s, that it's not just, we're not talking about cultural designations. We're talking about race kind of categorization for the purpose of stratification.
Mm-hmm.
So categorizing people, not just to say, oh, this is interesting to learn about them, but to initially explicitly stratify them. And I would make the case still today to implicitly stratify them. And we can see that amongst a variety of data points where we see racial disparity in place. And so anti-racists believe in resisting that. They would say that that exists. Now, some people would say that doesn't exist. So if you don't think that exists, then obviously you can't be an anti-racist because you don't agree on the bottom fundamental presupposition that racism is a thing, okay?
Correct.
But anti-racists would say, and this would borrow from Kendi's language, which I think is helpful, that it's not good enough to say, I'm not a racist.
Right.
Because that's kind of in the water. So we would have to actively be resisting the racism, thus the anti-piece, the pushing back on it. And the ways that we push back on it, right, is within ourselves, our own thinking, our own kind of biases that we have in whole, but also in policies, in laws, and practices. And so we have to engage enough to have an awareness to understand the way that racism is working itself out in our society today. So that's a long answer, but I wanted to at least give some context to the people.
So I want to first just say that I loved your book and would recommend it as highly as possible to the audience. Like, I think it will probably actually be my number one, like, give this book to, like, a starter book for somebody, particularly somebody who's coming from a Christian or, you know, Christian-esque, you know, Christendom, American,
Christian-y.
Like, Christian tangent background. To get them Christian-y, to get them into the conversation and to get them started, I think it was just a great resource. So thank you for it. One of the things I want to kind of talk about here is just how, for me, I struggle with just looking around. And you talked about how Christians on surveys and survey research that you guys conducted gave answers to some of the questions that weren't just not an improvement from non-Christians or people who are coming from a non-Christian background, but we're actually worse. We're actually more racially problematic. And for me as a Christian, and I think for our listeners who are coming from a Christian background, there's this disconnect between what I see in the Bible that seems so obvious and Christianity in America when I look around and see it. And so for that, I just picked out three passages I'm going to read real quick that I think if conservatives knew that these were in the Bible, they'd probably try to get the Bible banned from schools these days with all these book bans, because this would get accused of being CRT. But God says, "Woe to those who make unjust laws, to those who issue oppressive decrees to deprive the poor of their rights and withhold justice from the oppressed of my people, making widows their prey and robbing the fatherless. The oppressor will come to an end and destruction will cease. The aggressor will vanish from the land. In love, a throne will be established. In faithfulness, a man will sit on it, the one from the house of the David, one who in judging seeks justice and speeds the cause of righteousness. Learn to do right, seek justice, defend the oppressed, take up the cause of the fatherless, plead the case of the widow." And then I see that everywhere in the Bible. This is not just, like, I one time compiled 5 full Word document, 10-point font pages of verses just like this. And then you look at Christianity in America right now, and a majority of it is like doesn't reflect this. How did we get here?
All right, I'll take a stab at that one. One of the things I do enjoy about your podcast is the fact that you talk about issues outside of race. So I'm going to get to your question, but I just want to touch on the fact that any time that we as Christians ignore or neglect portions of Scripture, it's a combination of the world, the flesh, and the devil, right? Like the three great adversaries of our souls. And so I think that if we look at this in any area of morality or ethics, we're going to see Christians will have a tendency to downplay parts of Scripture that are really challenging them. It's why we need the Holy Spirit. It's why we need other Christians. It's why we need good preaching. It's why we need to study the Scripture for ourselves. So I don't think it's unique to racism or injustice or social justice in the sense that it's different. But I do think that it is very unique in the United States, kind of going back to what Christina said about kind of the mental scaffolding that we have to produce as white people in order to justify systemic oppression and injustice, that we are, we've inherited 400 years of religious, social justification for oppression and creating systems that give us advantage. And so we've been taught well, I guess, over many generations about how to ignore those type of passages. And we've picked that up, I think, in the church to the degree that's now, you know, quite obvious that, especially with our research, you know, we see these things and we even did we go into it in the book, but we ask a very similar verse to the one you read. And we asked those Christians who identify themselves as believing that the Bible should be used to determine what was right and wrong. And we asked them, well, do you think there should be laws that protect foreign workers? And about half, I can't remember the exact number, but a large percentage said yes, but then a large percentage said no. And then we asked the question again, so kind of similarly worded, and we said, well, in the Bible, it says such and such and such and such. Well, we saw when we asked that question again, about half of the people, I think, or about 67%, if I remember right actually now. So a large number of those people who originally said no, when we actually gave them a verse, flopped and said, okay, yes, now I think we should do that, which is great. It's also, that's a great incentive to teach all of the Bible, because apparently a lot of those people didn't even know that verse was in the Bible. But then we still have this whole other 30% of that group that was like, even though a Bible verse is there, you know, I've still got, you know, some kind of justification for neglecting it. So it's kind of a roundabout answer to your question. I think there's a lot of reasons for that. We could go into some of the specifics on it, but I just think we can't understand why Christians can ignore and neglect so much of the scripture without seeing the 400 years that got us to this point.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
So in Faithful Anti-Racism, y'all describe magical thinking. Can you define what magical thinking is and how it doesn't work to create change? And then start to talk about how you've actually seen change happen effectively and what are some of the obstacles to change in organizations?
Yeah, so magical thinking basically are, scenarios that we make up in order to psychologically justify or to explain a scenario that's before us that we may not want to reckon with. It may cause us to have some type of existential crisis, tension with our family systems. I mean, there are all kinds of consequences for, I think, reckoning with, for example, the topic that we're talking about, racism. And so magical thinking becomes a way for us to manage kind of the cognitive dissonance that we have, the way that, you know, who it is that we believe we are as people. Most people would say that they think they're good people, but at the same time, maybe participating in unjust practices or ignoring them. So we have to figure out how to reckon with that. Like, our brain will keep nagging us. And unless we fix that, you know, and if we decide we're not going to fix that, then we create kind of cognitive scenarios to make sense of it. Doesn't mean that it's truly full of sense. It could be nonsensical. Thus, magical thinking can take place to explain why something is existing in front of us. And we can also employ kind of magical thinking as a way to fix a problem or to fix an issue, right? So we think about an issue of racism, which has multi-generational, economic, psychological ramifications that we can look at in a variety of spheres of society. We can look at disparities in health, in income, in the way neighborhoods were shaped and set up. I mean, across all these different variables. And so it really takes some work. It takes some cognitive fantasy to be able to kind of wish that away if you're not going to do something about it, or to respond to that by saying, like, oh, you know how we can fix that longstanding systemic issue or all this racial disparity? Let's just have coffee together. I think that'll do it. Like, let's just, you know, let's just invite a Black person over to dinner. this is going to fix the problem that we have. And I would say that that likewise is also a bit of magical thinking, to think that we can just kind of have, we can coffee our way through hundreds of years of systemic oppression.
Well, and I think it's Charles W. Mills who speaks, who coined the term white ignorance. Mm. And it's just that willfulness of ignorance in order to ignore the obvious.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, psychologists talk about strategic ignorance. And in that sense, that particular reference is thinking specifically about how that group who identifies as white might engage in this kind of selective ignorance, right, as to not change the phenomenon of racism that is before us. But strategic ignorance is something that all of us can employ at times. It's kind of like, I don't want to know.
Right.
Gotcha. And I imagine that all of us have matters and things in our lives that we don't really want to know more about quite yet. We can find ourselves employing strategic ignorance.
Mm-hmm. So is tokenism something you would put under the idea of magical thinking? And can you kind of explain what that is and how it's powerless to change organizations?
Yeah, so I'll let Chad take it away. But I was going to say, you know, tokenism just obviously it uses people, right? It's a puppeteering. It's a mask that is devoid of power, and ultimately racism and stratification is about power. And so someone kind of playing a role without actual power is going to be a problem if they're going to be being used in that scenario. But Chad, take it away.
All right. You know, one way to think about the book is like the first half is kind of foundational things that we felt like were really key for people to know before we could actually get to the real specific, you know, here's the nuts and bolts of what we recommend, you know, that Christians do. And so we felt like we need to lay some foundations in the past, in the present, biblical concepts, biblical principles, current data, all those things. But before we get to the second half, that's where that magical thinking and magical chapter that faithful anti-racists don't rely on magic. And so what we wanted to do first was cover both on the individual side and the organizational side. Here are things that we frequently see people use that don't work. And so sometimes no solution is actually less problematic than the wrong solution. So we have to kind of understand this is where we're getting it wrong. And so, yes, tokenism is absolutely a big issue. We see it all the time in organizations. So on the organizational side, tokenism, kind of pseudo power sharing, super, super common. A couple other magical things that we see all the time too is training programs that are going to, you know, fix everything. And then those have all kinds of problematic elements to them. They can be great. Christine and I lead them all the time, but training problems can be really problematic if we think they're going to do too much. There's a lot of things like, and we even have in there too, like statistical diversity, like I mentioned. A lot of organizations say, well, all we need to do is get diverse, or we need to reach some kind of statistical threshold. If we're only 20% of people of color, then now we're statistically multiracial and we've arrived and all those things. But we see, and Dr. Corey Edwards has done some great research on this as well, is that you can have 80% people of color in a Christian organization and it can still be white dominated.
Yep.
So statistically, that doesn't tell you much. What you really need to get at is what's going on. Are you using a tokenistic approach? Is it performative? Is it, you know, true leadership sharing? So yes, there are lots of things that we use that don't get the job done.
Yeah.
Well, and I mean, even when you,
No, I was going to say to Chad's point, you know, that one of my last international trips before COVID shut the party down was to South Africa. And to Chad's point about how we can often think the amount of people, if there's that percentage piece, that's going to shift issues related to racial inequity. South Africa, I think, is a glaring example of a nation that is overwhelmingly, you know, upwards to 80% Black South African, and a 10% largely Afrikaner, European immigrant African population that retains significant power. And even with a Black African government, the the economic system of South Africa is largely in the hands of white Africans. And so so I think that oftentimes we think, you know, if we can get the picture to look a certain way, if the picture looks inclusive, that means that we have properly dealt with this matter of power and equity. And oftentimes we have not. That's the uncomfortable part.
Mm-hmm. And I think you guys talk about how that can even be counterproductive, because then it leaves the leadership feeling like yes, they've done something when really they haven't.
And we also go to, quickly, we also go into two really important concepts there too, assimilation and code switching. So a lot of times what we see in organizations is that the people of color in the organizations are either assimilating or code switching. So there's this impression of diversity, but they really can't be themselves. They're forced to kind of change who they are, or be silent about who they are. So there really isn't diversity in the organization. It's just superficial diversity.
So I don't want you to necessarily reveal all your trade secrets here, but when you're doing a workshop, or like what's the solution then? Like, where do you go from there if you don't want the magical thinking, but want to create real change? And some of our listeners, presumably, actually, I know that some of them lead organizations. So how do they start to create true change?
Yeah. One thing I'll throw out quickly is that, you know, people have to have enough emotional maturity to start to do this work. Now, that doesn't mean that we're going to wait for everybody to catch up. So in other words, if you have power and position, I would encourage you to do what is right today. but for those people who may not have the ability to do that, right, then you're going to want to make sure that the people in your organization have kind of the emotional maturity to be able to approach this topic well and deeply. And also, even though we said it's not a numbers game, numbers do matter. And so I do care about people's hiring practices, how many employees of color actually make it through to the interview stage, how far they get in the process. So those things actually are important to document, right? So what we're measuring can be an indication of what we value in an organization, but oftentimes we're measuring the wrong things. and so I would say, yeah, preparing the people well in terms of just emotional health, and obviously tying that into the mission of the organization is just something that, you know, trainers and organizational consultants do. We want to make sure that this is not an appendage to the organization's mission or identity, but it is a clear fruit of it. It's deeply rooted in it. So if we're working with a church, this should be an easy thing, an easy case to make. Not always, but it should be. But with any organization, we just want to make sure that this work of pursuing anti-racism within their practices is tied into their missional identity, because it's going to get quite hard. It's going to get really, yeah, really difficult. And it's going to be easy to kind of cut and run unless this is who you are. It's going to need to be who you become. So that's how I would just start that there.
Yeah, kind of related to that, I would just say that it's really important to have I would argue as a Christian, to have a biblical and informed approach. So that's one of the reasons I love your podcast. I think you're doing a fantastic job of helping people to have foundations to understand these really complex topics. So you got to need to understand the history of race in the United States. It's also really important to understand the history of race in your own organization. So a lot of these organizations, denominationally within the organization, and even if you've only been a church for 30 years, well, I guarantee you there's a race story there. So like, what is that story?
Yeah.
You know, putting some handles on the, how have our hiring practices been handled? Have we shared leadership? Why not? Are we ignoring those passages you talked about? So those kind of things, like being honest about the past in society, in ourselves, in our organizations. So a lot of times when I work with leaders, and we observe often is that there's kind of this, like, I know I need to do something, we kind of jump into it, but it's not really well informed. It's not really well thought through. And then there's failure, there's hurt, and then they get set back. I'm not going to mess with that. But it wasn't because it was a bad idea. It's because they took it in a really kind of presumptuous, uninformed way and kind of wrecked things. And so that's a big part of it. But then in the book, we go into a lot of other things we could talk about if we have time. But I think it's really important to get some outside perspectives in many cases, mentors, coaches, people that are knowledgeable on these issues. And it can be really, really beneficial for those people to be outside your typical circle for a variety of reasons. One is you avoid groupthink. So the people around you in your organization, it's very likely that they're going to be thinking similarly to you. So if you bring in some people from the outside, they're going to have a fresh perspective. That's really important. Another reason why it's really beneficial too is the people around you, oftentimes, especially the people of color, will have a price to pay. So if they're candid with you about, hey, you know, that was kind of insensitive, the way you said that. Well,
yes,
that could distance you from them. It could even, in many cases, you could lose your job, or you could lose your ability to get promoted or a leadership position. So many times people of color will talk with us kind of offline and say, oh, I wish I could say such and such to so-and-so, but they can't because it literally will hurt their careers. So, but if you bring in an outside coach, and you're honest with them and you allow them to really understand what's going on, then they can be more candid with you because you can't fire them. So that's one piece. And then another, we spend a whole chapter in the book about the importance of measuring progress. So, you know, we're really, especially modern day churches, are really into measuring things, but oftentimes we don't measure things that the Bible measures. And I think, you know, to your point about those hundreds of passages you mentioned, the Bible places extreme emphasis on issues of justice and in our dynamics with one another. And yet oftentimes that's completely neglected when we measure progress and success. And so I'm hoping and praying for the day where that's a more integral part of what Christian value, Christian organizations value.
Real quick, talk about that. There's like a survey that you have created for people both to take for themselves, like an inventory, and I think for their organization as well. And we can put the link to that in the show notes, but tell our listeners what they would get out of going through that.
Yeah, I'd love to. So we, as a foundation for the book, we did a 2-year national research project in partnership with Dr. Michael Emerson, who wrote Divided by Faith. To our knowledge, it's the largest study of racial dynamics in U.S. Christianity that's been conducted. If you're interested in learning about that, you can go to rrjp.org. That'll tell you all about our 2-year national research project. Coming out of that, we use that research, our own experiences, a whole bunch of other leaders, and we developed a new assessment tool we've been working on actually for years. It's been a really big project, and it's really close to going online. It's not available quite yet to the public, but literally within weeks, we hope to have that available to
awesome.
Take that assessment both for yourself and your organization. You can go to rrjp.org, and if it's not available when you go there, sign up on the newsletter, and we'll let you know when it is.
I've got a quick question before we enter time. You guys both seem like you're not angry people. Like, you guys have been smiling a lot during this. And so I just wonder, as somebody, you know, we just have this little podcast. You guys are seemingly doing like some really great work with leaders, and you travel, and it just is like a different level. So I'm assuming you run into some opposition and some like disappointment, but maybe from a high 10,000 foot view, like, how do you guys not just give up and just get so mad and just want to like throw in the towel? And like, I don't know, it's difficult. I run into opposition in my little tiny world, and I'm like, I'd get so disappointed. But how do you guys, you know, how do you stay healthy?
Well, I hope I'm healthy. Lord help me. I hope I am. So, a couple of things, and I think that's a fair, and it's a really, really good question. I don't necessarily think that anger is an issue. I think that there are times when we're not angry enough, and we're not angry about the right thing. So yeah. I think so. My sense of kind of being angry at injustice, kind of hopefully, is a righteous indignation, right? But oftentimes, what's underneath anger is kind of one of those like second tier emotions. Typically, what's underneath it usually is great disappointment. It could be fear. The sense of being let down. And I think I try to get to what is underneath my anger so that anger doesn't necessarily run me, right? That I can experience it, I can process it, but it's not dragging me all around. And again, that requires, I think, some intentional work, kind of looking within to do that. The other thing I would say is that the reason why I do this work, and I laid out that early on with the kind of initial questions, I think in order to have stamina in this work, and obviously we are people of faith, we are Christians, it's going to have to be undergirded by love. Now, I know that sounds like, that may sound like a tree hugging good time for some people that are listening, but I mean, it has to be at the root of this. Because if it's fear, fear only lasts for so long, and then it eats you up. And again, it oftentimes is a foundational emotion, but then it can turn into anger. But love, I think, fuels the type of imagination as well as truth telling. So love fuels an imagination that this could actually look different than it does. This could look different than it does, but it also lets you tell the truth about it really is jacked up. Like as I look at both the sociological data, as I look at what we're seeing, we're seeing just throughout the states on this issue, it does not look encouraging. It looks troubling and disturbing. And yet, love, I think, fuels me to have kind of this, what I would call a holy imagination of the possibilities of what could be or what can be. And then also love fuels us to have something called courage. And you cannot do this work without courage. Right now, there are, I imagine, countless pulpits in the United States of Christian churches where you have leaders who have yet to say January 6th was a problem.
Right.
And it is because of a lack of courage. It's because of a lack of courage. Or maybe they don't know that it was a problem, but it was a problem. And so we have to be fueled by love, I think, to have the type of courage that calls us to show up and to say things that maybe people don't want to hear, but are necessary for our communal health and growth together.
Yeah. And you mentioned love and fear. And one other that I kind of just was recently thinking about is shame and how a lot of on the left, shame is used as a way to push back against racism and evil, which shame, I think, can prevent negative behavior, but it can't actually inspire positive action. It can just like stop the bad.
Yeah.
But love.
And I would make the case that you can't shame white supremacy.
No.
Mm-hmm. You can't do it. I mean, in the United States, we had slave blocks where children were stood before people and sold. Mm-hmm. You cannot shame white supremacy away. It is indeed shameless. Now, by that, I don't mean that white individuals cannot experience shame, but I mean this phenomenon of white supremacy. It's quite resilient. I mean, you have to remember what it endured. It endured the stacking of bodies on slave ships. It endured the genocide of indigenous people, internment camps for many groups, but specifically thinking about the Japanese in the country. If you could shame white supremacy, we would be good right now. So, and also, I just don't think that's a way to win people. Again, this is a part of our faith, my faith conviction. And I would say Chad would agree that we, to use real Christian language, we wrestle principalities, we win people, and not the other way around. I have no interest in wrestling people or winning over evil. Instead, we're going to push back against the wicked and broken system, and we're going to try to win our neighbor, even the one who thinks that they're our enemy right now. Ultimately, I think God has the final say about that.
That's so good.
So as we wrap up, I'm going to land the plane with something I'd like you guys to speak to, because the bottom line, as we wait and as long as anti-racism has to exist, the oppressed, we are tired. We are exhausted. The fact that anti-racism is even a thing, the emotional, psychological, physical, sociological, economical toil that it's taken on a 400 plus year collective of people, while we wait, we weep, we wail and mourn, I'd like for you to just speak and encourage, because what we're seeing specifically in the church, as we're speaking as Christians, there's a tremendous fallout from racism that's really happening. It's really impact the church, and the church is losing a hold. We're seeing white people, young white people specifically, that are leaving white churches, evangelical churches, and because of their parents and their elders' hypocrisy and racism. And we're seeing young black people leaving the faith. And when I say leaving the faith, I will put that in quotes because, you know, there's so much nuance there. But we're seeing from deconstruction, which, you know, some have tried to demonize that whole process, which I think that we should all be kind of engaging and deconstructing and challenging the elements of Christianity that we have that are man-made and not an extra biblical and that uplift and uphold racism. But there's a shaking up that's happening and a great fallout that's happening. And for those of us who are BIPOC, like, we are weary. And we're about to enter into the resurrection weekend, Passover being crucified and him rising on the third day And there are so many and with COVID even, that's amplified it. And with the world events that have happened, that's amplified it. Can you guys speak to that and encourage the weary listener, the weary soul?
Well, like Christina shared, you know, as Christians, I feel that we, you know, we do truly have access to inexhaustible love and inexhaustible hope. And so when my tank's dry and I'm discouraged and I'm really frustrated, that is the well that I have to go to. That's where I have to return to Christ to basically say, you have to give me what I need to continue to do this work. And it's just, even the, you know, tomorrow's Good Friday. So, you know, even Christ's death on the cross and its power over all things evil is such an incredible source of hope and joy for this work. I mean, so that's everything that evil could throw at him, and he wins. So, you know, that gives me great hope as I think about this work. There's nothing that can be thrown at us. There's nothing big, too big, that's impossible, that's too big for Christ.
Yeah, and I definitely, I'm a person who lives Sunday to Sunday. And when I think about the Christian faith, for me, I'm largely thinking about two things are at work. Both, one is resistance.
Yeah.
Resisting my own kind of sinful inclinations and my lies in my own brain, and resisting the sins in the world. Injustice and cruelty and war and wickedness. So it's we're called to resist, right? Ourselves and things outside of ourselves, right? Sometimes people overemphasize one of those things over the other. And then we're also called to rest.
Yes.
We're called to rest. It's a command, y'all. Yes. It's a command. Yes. And I think it has to be a command, because otherwise we might actually think that we are holding up the cosmos.
Yeah.
And we're not.
We're not.
And the Christian life actually starts with the Sabbath.
Mm.
It starts, the week begins, the life begins with resting. And from rest, we move from rest to do the resisting. And I have to constantly remind myself that, as somebody who is quite just ungodly busy.
Yes.
And Chad is nodding like, yes, I know.
Yes.
But I really do believe that we have to start from a place of rest. I don't know how we can expect anybody to have a good attitude if they're tired and they're broke down. And I think the way that, and the sharpness that you have to have, I think, in order to engage people
mm-hmm.
who are afraid and who are angry and who are having an existential crisis when you talk about the realities of racism.
Yeah.
Because they're like, but this is what my mom taught me, and my Sunday school teacher, they were so kind, and, you know, what are you telling me about my childhood church, right? To be able to be present and to love and to be truthful, right? To not break. You have to start from a place of rest. Like, we're not working in order to rest. We start from a place of rest. And I would, whether someone's a believer or not, whether you're a Christian or not, I would commend that to you. To shift a little bit, to think about Sunday as our starting point, to give us what we need to move forward in this work. And then ultimately, you know, I can't change people. I can't change a human heart. I have some skills as a psychologist to understand behavioral change and change process. Yeah. But I can't really change myself sometimes.
Come on.
You know, I can't really,
yes,
you know, there
indeed.
Are things that I can't, you know, that I have patterns that I'm still trying to get unstuck from. So there's a sense of, I think, joyful and restful release that I'm going to do what I can. I'm going to sow seeds. I'm going to do good intentional work with the skills that I have. You know, Chad and I have partnered together, trying to bring together the best skills from our experiential skills, our lives, but also our academic skills and professional skills. And we've put it on the table and said, okay, Lord, use it. And we hope that what comes out of it is something that will really, really help and bless people. But ultimately, we know that this work of heart change is not our work to do. We don't have that divine power.
One last thing I want to throw in before you jump in. The last thing is, I want to say too, in the terms of hope, you guys give me hope, honestly.
Mm.
Like, when I'm working with people around the country, like you guys, doing this kind of work in thoughtful ways, in honest ways, with a lot of hard work and, insights, I mean, that's super encouraging. So yes, keep it up. You guys are doing fantastic work.
Thank you so much. And you guys are doing such a wonderful work. Thank you so much for this labor of love that you have put out and worked and collabed and put together for us to give us a model of what, you know, the and the framework of what a faithful anti-racist is and what that work looks like.
Yeah, thank you so much. We have a code in the show notes. Go buy this book and go read it and tell all your friends.
With the code, you get 30% off.
Yeah, check it out.
So now's the time.
Thank you guys again. Man, if you guys ever decide to do a podcast, you need to let me know. Because I'd be interested in helping with that. But thank you guys so much.
You guys have been such a blessing. I wish we could talk more. It's been a great, great time. And for me personally, just something that I need as I'm going into this weekend, because there's so much to be sad about, because we don't do church the same anymore. And we aren't, there's ways that we've just been changed forever as a generation of believers. And there's a lot to lament, but then there is hope and there's a lot to be encouraged and strengthened and joyous about. So, because he lives, he has risen. So thank you. Thank you guys so much.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, thank y'all so much. And yeah, have a joyful and honest Resurrection Sunday.
Y'all
the Lord
too.
The Lord is not afraid of our real feelings, by
no,
the way.
He is
so
not.
You can come in there wobbling.
Amen. Amen.
Before your computer,
crawling.
Wherever you go.
Yeah, yeah, yes indeed.
Well, Jesus really, really does identify with brokenness.
Yes, he does.
I mean, what other God says, to identify with you, I will become like you. I will bleed like you. I will sweat like you. I will cry like you. I will weep over a lost loved one just like you
do.
Yes. And that way, when Christ intercedes now as our great high priest, he really gets it. He really gets you.
Yes.
He really gets you. So anyway, good meeting y'all.
Y'all too. Thank you so much. Y'all take care.
Yeah. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you so much, you guys.
Thanks for listening to this episode. If you are looking for more information on what we discuss, take a look at the show notes or go to blackhistoryforwhitepeople.com. And again, just a reminder, go buy this book. Use the link in our show notes. You can go buy the book at Ivy Press and use the code BHISTORY. That's B as in boy, then history. All one word, BHISTORY. And that'll give you 30% off for the next 2 weeks from the launch of this episode. So make sure you go buy it. You can support us on Patreon for $5 a month at patreon.com/blackhistoryforwhitepeople. And just a reminder, very soon we're going to be launching a new website and we are going to be releasing a book in the coming months. And so be on the lookout for that. We're really excited about the opportunity of sharing a little bit more with the world in a book form. We'll leave you with this quote from the book, Faithful Anti-Racism. Imagine how different our society could be if our cultural and ethnic differences were a source of strength and joy rather than a source of division, conflict, and injustice.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.